Hello and welcome to the first episode of Supermates, the husband and wife Geekcast. I'm the husband in question, Chris Franklin.
And I'm the wife, Cindy.
This podcast is going to be a free-for-all of all things geeky. Comics, movies, TV shows, sci-fi, fantasy, classic horror, you name it, we like it, and we're going to talk about it. Cindy and I both love this stuff, and we talk about it all the time anyway, so we thought we'd put our conversations out there for you to share.
And hopefully somebody will actually want to listen to this, but we'll see.
Yeah, you know, nobody listens to it, you know, we'll probably still do it, but, you know, we hope you listen to it anyway. Before we get started, I think introductions are in order. Some of you may know me from my co-hosting gig on several episodes of the Power Records podcast over at the Fire and Water podcast feed. The Fire and Water podcast was actually the first one I listened to, specifically the Who's Who episode. I think I started with the first one, and I've been like obsessed with it ever since.
A little bit.
Yeah. Soon I was going back and listening to all the older Fire and Water podcast, and there I followed Shag over to some of Michael Bailey's podcasts, like Views from the Long Box, and then I heard Andrew Leyland on that show, and I followed him back to his Hey Kids comic show that he does with his son Michael, and you know, I was really getting into podcasts, and then
it's kind of like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. They're all interconnected at some point or another.
Right. It is. It's like there's like four guys making a podcast, and three of them are Michael Bailey. So Rob asked me if I wanted to co-host Power Records episode with him, and I was glad to do it, and had a great time, and I just kind of got the bug from that. So I've been wanting to do a podcast, but I wasn't sure what the subject was going to be. I knew it was going to be about comics and, you know, geeky stuff in general, but I just didn't have a, you know exactly what I wanted to do. But
you kept bouncing ideas off of me, and I'm like, why don't you just do a show like this where you tell, you know, we talk about this and just record that, because that's what we do all the time anyway.
Right. So, you know. Yeah, I listened to my better half, so here we are. Well, about 23 years ago, Cindy and I were both in high school, and we were friends, and she came over to my house, my parents' house, with some of our other friends, and I was mortified because I had a huge crush on her, and I didn't have any idea how she was going to react to the comics, the posters, the action figures, all over my room. You know, it's the thing all of us guys just flip out about, and I'm sure girls do too that are into this stuff. You know, what are they going to think about all this stuff? So I'm just sweating bullets, and she comes into my room, and you know, she looks around, and she sits down on my bed, and she picks up a comic book, starts reading it. And I knew then that it was meant to be, so... That's our origin story as far as...
In the words of Mary Jane Watson, you hit the jackpot.
That's right. I'm not a tiger, but I hit the jackpot. But enough of our mushy stuff. We're going to talk today about mushy stuff that leaked into our superhero comics. In honor of Valentine's Day, we're going to talk about some of the best, most beloved couples in comics. And I think we'll stick to married couples. Just since, you know, we're married and it makes sense. Since we can blame this show mostly on Rob Kelly and his Aquaman shrine, I think it's only appropriate we start out with Aquaman and Mira, the king and queen of the seven seas.
Aquaman, swift and powerful monarch of the oceans, with ability to summon and command all creatures of the deep. Aquaman, who with his teenage ally, Aqualad, guards and defends all that lives in the seas against the forces of evil. Aquaman, king of the seven seas.
Aquaman debuted in More Fun Comics number 73, 1941, and led a pretty lonely existence for nearly 20 years, first in that title and then in Adventure Comics. He had no supporting cast, no sidekick, and no love interest. As the Silver Age began in the late 50s, Aquaman received a pet sidekick in Topo the Octopus, a new origin tying him to the lost continent of Atlantis, and eventually a kid sidekick named Aqualad. Aquaman also finally graduated to his own series after years as a backup character, no doubt in part due to his exposure in DC's top-selling Justice League of America title. It was in his own title that Arthur Aquaman Curry first met a curvy redhead in a green-scaled bodysuit, complete with flippers. It was Aquaman number 11, October 1963, and the lady's name was Mira. And she was a beauty, as drawn by the master of the female form, Nick Carty. Mira was the exiled queen of a water dimension, and through the course of the story, Aquaman helped free her kingdom. She was no slouch in the powers department, with her ability to manipulate water into hard objects, such as weapons. Her kingdom was now safe, but Mira had fallen in love, and a few months later, she returned to the Earth-1 dimension Aquaman called home in Aquaman number 18. It was a short one-issue courtship because in that very same issue, in a ceremony attended by the entire Justice League, the two were wed. It must have been one hell of a fruitful honeymoon because only 4 months later, they had a son.
Well, they are part fish people.
Well, that's true. Maybe it was a shotgun wedding. Mm-hmm. Underwater shotgun wedding or something. Their bouncing, or floating, baby boy was named Arthur Jr., but mostly called by the unfortunate name of Aqua Baby.
Whenever I hear the name Aqua Baby, it always makes me think of the dolls I used to play with when I was a little girl named Seaweeze. Very odd. So odd.
When you found those at a show, I was like totally just floored. Not that I played with, girl toys, but I remember most commercials for most of those things. I had no idea they were ever made. Didn't Kenner make those?
I believe so. I'd have to actually look to find out.
Same people that made the strawberry shortcakes, which and the superpowers line, which that's what's important, and Star Wars.
More important than strawberry shortcake, we might have to talk about this.
Yeah, okay. Mira and Aquaman had a happy marriage through typical DC Silver Age adventures for several years, under Carty, writers Jack Miller and Bob Haney, and editor George Kasdan. But sales began to decline, and the title was given a shakeup by incoming editor Dick Giordano, who brought along some of his fellow Charlton Comics pros, writer Steve Skeets and artist Jim Aparo. These folks created a truly legendary run on the title, their most famous story revolving around Aquaman's desperate search for a kidnapped Mira. Eventually, husband and wife were reunited, but they didn't get to stay happy very long. Their title was canceled with issue number 56, April 1970. Aquaman made occasional appearances as a member of the JLA, but Mira was sidelined until the feature returned to its old home in Adventure Comics and eventually a revived Aquaman title. It was there that a storyline began that would forever alter the dynamic of the once happy couple, the death of their son, and a storyline winding through issues 57 through 62 in 1978. From this point on, Aquaman and Mira's relationship is strained, to say the least. The Aquaman strip bounced around from title to title, often with gaps of several years between new stories. Each incoming writer felt the need to readdress their hardships anew, even if the previous writer had seemingly laid them to rest. The recurring plot of Mira leaving Arthur over his neglecting her for superheroics came up again and again. During one of these periods, he disbanded the JLA and reformed it, using only fully committed members who would give their whole lives to the team. You know, people like Vibe. Just a few issues later, Aquaman left his new team hanging to, you guessed it, search for Mira. The couple were reunited and all seemed to be going well again. Fast forward a few years, and the couple have hit rock bottom. Thanks to post-crisis retconning, actual specifics of old storylines were slightly askew, and Mira is depicted as insane in an Atlantean asylum in the 1989 Aquaman miniseries, which Rob just loves, by the way. Mira now blames her husband for their son's death, saying that his weak genes doomed their boy. After a heated battle, it seems Arthur has accidentally killed his former love. But Mira's other dimensional physiology, that's a big word.
It is. I mean, you only have a $2 allowance, and you used all $5.
I know it. Her other dimensional physiology has saved her, and she leaves our dimension in a huff, for good. Yeah, right. Mira eventually returns in Peter David's 90s run on Aquaman, but by this time her ex has lost a hand, gained a harpoon hook thingy, and a beard, and has gotten way moody. He's also shacking up with Dolphin, another undersea hottie from the Silver Age. Mira has been a prisoner of an otherworldly Aquaman doppelganger known as Thanatos. Not Thanos, but Thanatos.
Ah, and it's no confusion there.
No confusion there. I think Thanatos actually came first in the 60s Aquaman books, though, so they ripped him off.
And they had a son named AJ.
Yeah, they had a son named AJ. Yep, that's right. She's reading the notes, which I apparently can't. It's never explicitly stated if he belongs to Thanatos or Arthur. Eventually, AJ's age is accelerated and he becomes the Aquaman of another dimension, never to be heard from again. Mira and Arthur are at last reunited, and it feels so good. Aquaman passes off Dolphin over to his old psychic Aqualad, now known as Tempest. I wouldn't make a sloppy seconds joke, but I'd probably get slapped. Ow! The Aqua family had a good run, with Arthur and Mira becoming pseudo-grandparents when Tempest and Dolphin's son Saradin is born.
Oh, that's not weird. No, not at all.
No, just keep it in the family, man.
Ugh.
This happiness is cut short by DC's constant need to do world-shattering crossovers, and the 2000s are a hard time for the aquatic duo, with Arthur dying twice and the rest of the Aqua family dying seemingly forever, save for Mira.
Everybody always talks about them bringing Bobby back on Dallas. Read comic books and they will shut up.
Yeah, they got nothing on these guys. Soap operas have got nothing on comics. The events of Blackest Night and Brightest Day are way too complicated. See, I can't even say it. It's so complicated to get into here. But needless to say, Mira got a huge push from these events and her writer, Jeff Johns. Brought to the forefront of the DCU more than ever before, she was instrumental in stopping the Black Lanterns and bringing about the resurrection of her husband, Arthur, returned for the most part to his Silver Age glory. No hook hand, no water hand, just good old orange shirt, green glove Aquaman.
Good.
All of that was kind of meaningless, though, because before a planned Aquaman book could launch post-Brightest Day, the entire DCU was rebooted harder than ever before. Aquaman and Mira got a much-needed fresh start, with much of their agonizing backstory sponged away. Without the death of their now non-existent son hanging over them, the couple has managed to stay strong together, co-headlining one of the DC News' most popular titles. Surprisingly, Mira actually has a pretty good track record of following her hubby into other media. She was part of the 60s Superman-Aquaman Hour of Adventure, although she was treated more as a female friend than love interest or wife. During this period, Mira made it into Ideal's Comic Heroines Super Queens line of dolls. Mira's doll is actually the most accurate of the bunch, but like all the other dolls in that line, commands a huge aftermarket price due to low production from retail indifference, which I know makes you sad because you'd love to have one.
I would.
Yeah, I'd love for you to have
one,
too.
Even a repro.
Yeah, you could. Mira missed the boat on Aquaman's 13-year run on the Super Friends, never appearing on the show, although she did make it into the Associated comic. She made several appearances in Justice League Animated Series as Aquaman's wife and the mother of his child. Mira was portrayed as a doting wife trying to keep her outrageous husband on the ground in Batman the Brave and the Bold. There, Arthur Jr. was hale and hearty, although he was a disaffected youth, content to ignore everything and just keep his headphones on and the video game going. She also showed up on Young Justice, where her water-manipulating powers were tied into that show's version of Aqualad. The happy couple even got one episode of live action under their belts when Mira joined her hubby bro in a last-season episode of Smallville, passing some marital advice on to Lois Lane and kicking a fair amount of butt. So, you know, of all the different versions of Aquaman and Mira, what... like the different media versions, do you which version do you prefer?
I personally like the way she was portrayed on Batman Brave and Bold. I mean, that is just hilarious because she knows her husband's a nut, but she loves him and she loves her little boy, and you know, and he's your typical preteen. We've got one of those. God help us. And I could just see our son doing the same things he does. I mean, Batman Brave and the Bold. That's the way I like them. So, yeah. As far as for Smallville, you know, Lynn's okay, but the bro, dude, he's like so surfer dude. You know, there's only so much of that you can take and swallow with a straight face.
Well, I did like in the Smallville episode that it seemed like Mira had kind of toned the bro-ness down in that one. It's been a while since I watched it, but if I remember right, Arthur's speech patterns had gone beyond Cro-Magnon, man, you know. So that
was
good.
Well, like every good woman, you know, she helps her man there, baby.
She brings the man's level of intelligence up and teaches him poise and better manners. And
we try,
not
honey,
to call,
we try.
Not to call guys brawl and bro, and I didn't get the whole bra thing, but, you know, I love the Brave and the Bold. You know, that's just, when it first came on, I was a little, it took a while for me to get past Aquaman being that,
outrageous,
that over the top, but it really worked. And, you know, after so many years of angry, hook-handed Aquaman, people tend to beat up on that version, and it made DC a lot of money, and a lot of people really liked it for a long time, and it worked in the 90s, it did work, but it just, in hindsight, it's just kind of one of those, what? Just a lot of the stuff will be, you know, looked at, it's being published now, a few years from now, people will be like, they really did that? You know, but, you know, I think the best version of the hook-handed Aquaman was on the Justice League show.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, the whole deal where how he got his hook and, you know, to save his son.
Spoiler alert! Somebody might not have seen that episode.
If you haven't seen that episode, it's been 10 years at least since it was on. So I'm sorry. I'm going to spoil it for you. Aquaman takes his belt buckle and cuts his hand off to free himself so he can save his son. And that's just damn cool. I mean, I like that. As a dad, I would totally
be on board with that.
I would totally cut my hand off, and of course, you'll have to get a cool harpoon thing, you know, and grow a beard. And long hair wouldn't do me any good, but yeah. But I'd be one of those dudes with long hair in the back and, you know, solar panel up top. But
wrap that one string around.
Yeah, yeah.
Swirly.
But. Yeah, so, but, you know, I will be honest, I am not a fan of 99% of the new 52, but everything I know of the new Aquaman, I really think they've done a great job of making him and Mira a strong couple. You know, they've really, I think, listened to what the fans wanted with that character. They gave him a classic version of Aquaman, and making Mira a strong character in her own right, who could have her own book, honestly. I mean, that's just icing on the cake. They've just done a great job with those two.
Well, good. Alrighty. As Chris said, we spoke about DC's most famous married couple. Now we're going to hop on over to Marvel and talk about the Richards, Reed and Sue Storm. They premiered in the first issue of Fantastic Four in November of 1961, by Stan the Man Lee and Jack King Kirby. We all know the origin story of how Reed coaxed his fiancée Sue, her brother Johnny, and their friend Ben Grimm onto an experimental rocket flight, and how they were bombarded by cosmic rays that mutated them. Reed became the stretchy Mr. Fantastic, and Sue, the self-explained Invisible Girl. Still don't like that? Can't help it. Girl? No. What is often forgotten is how Reed and Sue originally represented something of a May-December romance, with Reed being portrayed as much older than Sue. In fact, it's revealed later in the course of the series that the four first met when college age, keep that in mind, Reed and Ben boarded at the home of Storm's aunt, who was raising the brother and sister. The barely teenage Sue fell madly in love with Reed, which made things a bit awkward for the brainy but somewhat socially stilted scientist. I'm sorry. Odd.
It's a little icky. A
little pervy. Years later, the four met again, and with Sue of age, oh, it's okay now, and Reed no longer thinking of her as jailbait. Oh, no. The two were engaged. Shortly thereafter, that tragic flight into space happened. And under Reed's leadership, the Fantastic Four was born, dedicating their newfound powers to the side of right and all that good stuff. The early FF stories definitely portray Sue as the weak link on the team, with her often the damsel in distress or withering flower who can't handle the latest terror the Fantastic Four face. Her confidence in the face of danger slowly increased, and she learned she could create invisible force fields and constructs as well. Sue and Reed became part of an odd love triangle when Namor the Submariner, sorry, cuter to me than Reed Richards. Sorry, can't help it.
He runs around with no shirt on. That doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
And those tight green shorts.
Again, yeah. Anyway, Namor takes a shine to Sue and makes several attempts to steal her away from Reed's stretchy arms. She should have run right into him. Reed always manages to win Sue back, and he makes it official in Fantastic Four Annual Number 3, where the two were wed in a prototypical comic book wedding with guest heroes and villains galore. Still have never understood that. As the 60s drew to a close, Sue became pregnant, and after a difficult pregnancy plagued with sci-fi camp complications, gave birth to their son, Franklin. Hey, our last name. That's cool. During this period, Sue took maternity leave and was briefly replaced in the Fantastic Four by Crystal of the Inhumans, who was then Johnny's girlfriend. Like many couples, Reed and Sue argued over issues regarding their kid. This being a Marvel comic, those issues were taken to the extreme when Reed essentially made Franklin a vegetable so his burgeoning mutant powers wouldn't wipe out the universe. Sue was not happy with her domineering hubby doing this, especially without her consent, and the two separated for some time. Sorry, separation would have been the last of his problems.
Other things would have been separated.
A little bit. This time, Sue was replaced on the team with Medusa, another Inhuman. Good thing there's a big old pool of those.
Yeah, there's like a humans lined up around the block waiting to get into the Fantastic Four.
Apparently.
Karnak's next.
Reed eventually finds a way to restore Franklin's mind and keep him from obliterating everything, and Sue returns to the team and her husband. Things for Reed and Sue are pretty much status quo for some time, and then she became pregnant with their second child. Her exposure to all sorts of cosmic radiation and other factors led to her losing the child. This left Sue in a vulnerable state, where she was easily manipulated by the Fantastic Four's old foe, the Psycho Man, who unleashed a dark persona known as Malice, replete with studded S&M gear. Sue proved she was the most powerful member of the Fantastic Four and decimated her teammates. Reed finally managed to have Sue unleash her full anger on him, which helped her to purge the Malice identity. Following this ordeal, Sue changed her name to the Invisible Woman, thank goodness, and was far more assertive on the team. Not long after, Reed and Sue took a leave of absence from the team, where they were briefly members of the Avengers before returning back to the Fantastic Four. Malice returned and Sue was forced to face her and ultimately absorb her into her own consciousness. This resulted in a much darker Sue who took to more violent uses of her powers and adopted a costume that would make Power Girl blush with a four-shaped peephole in the chest, high-cut undies, and thigh-high boots. Sounds like stripper gear. Around this time, Reed was presumed dead, having perished fighting the Fantastic Four's most persistent foe, Dr. Doom. Sue believed Reed was still alive, and the team searched for him, but her darker inclinations led her into the arms of Namor once again, who didn't seem to mind getting Reed's leftovers at this point. Reed eventually returned, and the remnants of Malice were finally purged by a time-traveling older version of Franklin. If you think this is weird, you have obviously forgotten about the convoluted backstory of Valeria. Valeria was originally thought to be the daughter of Sue and Dr. Doom from an alternate future, but Franklin revealed that he had saved Reed and Sue's stillborn second child from her womb and placed it in a different timeline. And if that wasn't wonky enough, Valeria is de-aged back into a fetus and put back into Susan's womb. Who says you can't go home again? Sue's second pregnancy with Valeria was no less difficult, and only the intervention of Dr. Doom helped the child to be born. He demanded that they keep the name Valeria and placed a spell on her so that she would one day betray the FF. Although this plan never came to fruition since the FF freed the girl from his control. During the events of Marvel's controversial Civil War event, the Richards family was torn apart, with Reed siding for registration of super beings and Sue decrying it. Sue sided with the heroes against the Ack and went underground with them, forcing her children to be left with Reed. Hunted and hounded as outlaws, Sue is nearly killed by the Taskmaster, but Reed takes the bullet for nearly losing his wife. Hey, if he did, she could go back to Namor. The rebel heroes are given amnesty, and Reed and Sue reconcile, leaving the FF for a time once more. You would think things would settle back down to normal after an event of this magnitude, but into today, everything's an event mentality of comics, there's no rest for the weary. Reed and Sue must suffer through both of them being temporarily replaced by Skrull doppelgangers, the temporary death of Johnny, and more drama than we can go into at this time. Needless to say, if these two can survive all this and still be together, their relationship is made of some pretty stern stuff. Reed and Sue have gone into other media hand in hand, beginning with the 1967 FF animated series by Hanna-Barbera. A second series in 1979 featured Reed, Sue, and Ben, but the infamous Herbie the Robot replaced Johnny for some reason. The entire FF returned to the screen as part of the Marvel Action Hour animated block in the mid-1990s, and they got a manga-esque makeover in Fantastic Four's World's Greatest Heroes in the mid-2000s. The FF almost made it into live action in the early 90s, but while the film was shot, it was never released. This version even includes a somewhat creepy backstory. There is no somewhat, it is creepy.
She's really young in that movie. She's like, she looks 13 and he's got to be at least 22 or something.
Yeah. Kind of like a whole Celine Dion, Renee. Blech.
Yeah, a little bit like that, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, backstory of the Storm's boarding house. The film's Fantastic Four and Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer portray Reed as much less assertive, often struggling with his leadership role. But Sue is a strong-willed woman, like her current comic portrayal. The two were wed on screen at the end of the second film. I loved all her wedding dresses in the movies. Those were so pretty. Sorry, it's a girl thing. You're listening to a chick, so there you go.
There's actually a documentary that's getting ready to come out called Doomed about the Roger Corman 90s Fantastic Four movie. And it's basically the story of how the movie was just put into production to hold the rights for the studio. They basically, as far as I know, and I could, my details might be foggy, but they basically sublent the movie to Corman Studios, which of course is a low budget studio, to keep the rights because they had to have a movie in production at a certain amount of time. They never planned to release it, but they didn't tell the people that actually worked on it.
Oh, it's got to suck.
Roger Corman knew, and very few others, as far as I know. And so and you know that movie, everybody's got a bootleg copy of that movie because they never released it. It's not great. In fact, parts of it are horrible, but it's got its heart in the right place.
The effects were really cheesy.
The effects are horrible. I mean, Johnny at the end when he flames on looks like the Game Genie guy from the Nintendo ads in the, 90s. And it's just, it's bad. But there's parts of it that they got better than the, I mean, I'm actually one of the people that actually, I know this is blasphemous, but I like the FF movies that they made, that had Jessica Alba as Sue. There's people that hate them. I kind of like them. There's parts of them that are Galactus is a cloud, but they should have tried to do Galactus as he was, but the one thing I can't forgive them, the Dr. Doom's horrible in those movies.
Oh, he eats more scenery than Shatner, and that's saying something.
Oh, you can't diss Shatner now. We can't, this podcast may be over before it begins, but.
No. You know as well as I do, and you have said that love is hard, Bill Shatner, Captain Kirk, love him to death, but he is a scenery chewer. And let's face it, old Dr. Doom, he chews more than him.
Well, now Dr. Doom in the comics actually is a pretty good scenery chewer too, but it's just, I just never saw Dr. Doom as the kind of smarmy, you know, corporate rich dude that guy, Nip/Tuck guy played. I can't even think of his name. I just didn't care. It wasn't his fault. I'm sure he was told to play that way, play with his type. But the guy in the Corman movie actually is pretty dead on Dr. Doom. I mean, the rest of it, you kind of debate, but, he was actually pretty good.
I don't know. I remember you and Andrew making me sit down and watch that Fantastic Four movie because there was nothing else to do. And I know it's not an experience that I'm going to repeat anytime soon. That's all I remember pretty much about it, and that it was uber creepy about the difference in ages.
Yeah, that was. Now, I will say in the movie, you don't get any idea that Reed is reciprocating. He just thinks it's cute that the little girl's got a crush on him. He's sweet to her. You don't get the idea that he's eyeing her and you're like, oh, wait till she grows up or nothing. You don't get that. Although, I will say that he wastes no time when they meet as adults. He starts macking on her. I mean, he's got his arm around her. You know, they're cuddling after they land on the lawn where the rocket blew up. I mean, it's, which there's like, four pieces of metal in somebody's backyard and that's where the rocket, that's where the rocket blew up. I'm exaggerating, but. But it's all, it, despite, like, again, I don't know why, how did we get on defending the Roger Corman FF movie? This is worse than defending Superman 4 or something. At least Superman 4's got Christopher Reeve. This has really nothing going for it. The Thing's effects aren't bad. The Thing suit's not bad.
I don't know. Chickless.
Okay. All right. Enough of the Fantastic Four. Okay, I hope you have some aspirin handy, because we're going to talk about Hawkman. And as any comic fan knows, when you talk about the history of Hawkman, you could possibly go insane trying to understand this. But I'm going to try to break it down, the relationship of Hawkman and Hawkgirl, in capsule form as best I can. So here we go. The first incarnations of Hawkman and the woman who would become Hawkgirl first appeared in Flash Comics number 1, in January of 1940, which of course means it shipped sometime in late 1939. The story was by Gardner Fox, and the art was by Dennis Neville. They were Carter Hall and Shira Sanders. They were also the reincarnated Prince Khufu and Shira, although I never understood why they didn't give her a different name. Later they spelled it different, but it still said Shira. But anyway, Hall finds out about his heritage and dons the Anubis-like wings and anti-gravity ninth metal of Hawkman. Unlike most Golden Age love interests, Shira was in on the secret from the start. She even temporarily fills in for Hawkman in All-Star Comics number 5, donning wings for the first time. Later in Flash Comics number 24, she officially adopted the name Hawkgirl and sporadically joined her bow in action from time to time. At first, Shira went maskless. She eventually adopted an exact duplicate of Hawkman's helmet, which was rather unflattering for an attractive young woman in a red halter top. Thanks to incoming artist Joe Kubert, Hawkgirl received a much more effeminate hawkhead helmet, and then finally a yellow half cowl to match her husband's switch over to a more standard superhero look. Fox's handling of the Hawks was fairly progressive for the time, with Shira usually treated as an equal partner and not just a sidekick or damsel in distress. This would continue on in every version of the duo. The Hawks held court until Flash Comics closed its door with issue number 104 in February 1949. The Winged Wonder also appeared in every issue of All-Star Comics, where he was a founding member of the Justice Society of America, as well as its longest-serving chairman. Even after Flash Comics was canceled, Hawkman continued to appear in JSA stories, but Shira was sidelined. The JSA closed its casebook in All-Star number 57, February-March 1951, and rolled up the carpet on the Golden Age of Comics. 10 years to the month later, Hawkman and Hawkgirl returned. Buoyed by the successful relaunch of Hawkman's former JSA teammates, The Flash, editor Julius Schwartz had set forth a Silver Age by dusting off the venerable characters of the JSA and giving them a new coat of paint. By this point, he and Gardner Fox had established the Golden Age heroes existed on a world known as Earth 2, while their new counterparts lived on Earth 1. It was Fox and editor Schwartz who introduced the world to a new Hawkman and Hawkgirl in the Brave and the Bold number 34. Artist Joe Kubert had also returned, but nearly everything else had changed. The Hawks were really Katar and Shiera Hall, married police officers from the planet Thanagar, who came to Earth in pursuit of a Thanagarian criminal. They liked our world so much they decided to stay, and due to their interest in ancient Earth weapons, took jobs as curators at the Midway City Museum, under the familiar cover names of Carter and Shiera Hall. In an era where Superman was constantly dodging marriage entrapment plots from Lois Lane, it was incredibly refreshing for these two superheroes to be happily married. Perhaps it was the successful chemistry of their marriage that allowed DC to let both Aquaman and Flash marry later in the decade. Hawkman's look was very similar to his classic Golden Age look, but Hawkgirl received a spiffy new headgear and fetching yellow top, which she kind of sort of has even to this day. After several tryouts in B&B and a run in Mystery in Space, the Winged Ones graduated to their own Hawkman title, while Kadar eventually joined the Justice League of America. The Hawks eventually lost their title, and throughout the Bronze Age they bounced from title to title, keeping a pretty consistent presence as a backup feature throughout the DC line. Due to changing bylaws, Hawkgirl was finally admitted to the JLA in 1977. Finally. She was a guest star a lot, but Supergirl never got in, even though she was a guest star a lot. During the early 80s, she changed her name to the more appropriate Hawkwoman. There you go again.
Thank you.
And by the middle of the decade, a new Hawkman title was launched. Meanwhile, the Golden Age Hawkman had returned with the JSA in 1963, and he participated in many of the JLA-JSA team-ups throughout the Silver and Bronze Ages. Shiera of Earth 2 didn't reappear until the 70s revival of All-Star Comics, and she never donned her wings. During their absence, they had married at some point. In Roy Thomas's retroactive opus All-Star Squadron, the Golden Age Hawk couple often appeared, with stories set in their heyday of the 40s. In present times, the Earth 2 Hawks were shown to have sired a son, Hector Hall, the hero known as the Silver Scarab. They were also godparents of Norda, also known as Northwind. Both of their kids were founding members of Infinity Incorporated, along with several other JSA offsprings and proteges. The Halls appeared alongside their children in the group's title during the mid-80s. Then DC published Crisis on Infinite Earths, and things got really weird for the Hawks. At the miniseries end, the worlds of Earth 1 and Earth 2 were merged, and the Golden Age Hawks were sent to fight an eternal Ragnarok cycle with the rest of the JSA. The Silver Age Hawks continued to appear as usual at first. They even joined the Wahaha Justice League of the late 80s briefly, with Katar portrayed as a hot-tempered old fart that longed for the good old days, and Shiera is the bemused lady who loved him. Post-crisis, DC was big on relaunching their marquee characters with revised origins and hot creators. Tim Truman revisited early Thanagar in the Hawk World miniseries and examined the Hawks' past on their planet like never before. The series was a success, and an ongoing series was ordered. Unfortunately, editorial decree posited that Hawk World's events were not set in the past, but happening concurrently with then-published DC books. So when the Hawks came to Earth in the first issues of their ongoing series, it was as if they had arrived here for the first time. This, of course, through years of continuity in total disarray. The Hawk World era Katar and Shiera were not married, just police partners, and the relationship was often strained. The new Shiera debuted as Hawkwoman and never went by the nom de plume Hawkgirl. Fans called foul, get it, on the huge hole left in the JLA's...
That was a very, very bad pun.
Yes,
very
it was. Bad. Thank you for noticing. On the huge hole now left in the JLA's history, DC tried to plug the dam as best they could with retroactive implants, but the damage was done. The convoluted Hawk continuity is one of the major reasons DC published the Zero Hour miniseries in 1994 in the hopes of streamlining and fixing their confusing continuity. In the course of that series, the post-crisis Hawkman and the Golden Age versions of both Hawkman and Hawkgirl are merged with a new post-Zero Hour Hawk version of Kater
like
Hall.
Two steps forward, four steps back.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, there's, he, well, he was more in touch with his feminine side after that. This didn't take well with fans, and Hawkman's series was canned once more. DC deemed the character radioactive, and no less than Grant Morrison was told he couldn't use him in his top-selling JLA relaunch of the late 90s. The powers that be wanted the stink of too many reboots to die off before putting him back out there. Boy, they don't have no problem with stinky reboots now, do they?
No.
They just reboot. They got so many boots that they ain't got a closet big enough to fit them.
Emil DeMarcos.
Yep. They weren't quite as adamant about Hot Girl, and she returned in the form of Kendra Saunders in the revived JSA series in 1999. Kendra was eventually revealed to be the latest reincarnation of her much older cousin, Shiera Sanders Hall, the Golden Age Hot Girl. She helped bring about the resurrection of Carter Hall, who was mostly the Golden Age Hawkman, but retained memories of the post-crisis zero-hour Kadar Hall as well. The Hawks flew over to a revived Hawkman title, which was really good at first, while still serving in the JSA. Their love story took a tragic turn, with Carter fully expecting their romance to pick up where they left off, and Kendra struggling with her reincarnation and ties to an unbreakable destiny. During the course of the series, it was revealed that the star-crossed couple had been several known DC characters in their past lives, such as the Old West heroes Nighthawk and Cinnamon. Just as they appeared to be coming closer to one another, more crises loomed. Crises? That is a word?
Crises?
Crises? I don't know.
Anyway, multiple crises.
Multiple crises. And on multiple Earths. The couple was put through the ringer in Infinite Crisis, with Hawkgirl taking over the Hawkman title briefly before its cancellation. During the Blackest Night crossover, the couple are killed and resurrected as evil Black Lanterns. At the conclusion of the series, they are resurrected, but by the end of the follow-up, Brightest Day, Hawkgirl is now one with the elements, and a lone Hawkman is left to mourn. In the New 52 universe, which launched shortly thereafter, Kadar Hall, a.k.a. Carter Hall, exist on the main Earth, while Kendra Saunders hails from a new version of Earth 2. It appears that the Wheel of Destiny that has previously linked these two together has, temporarily at least, blown a tire. The Hawks have flown into other media, with Hawkgirl taking a back seat up until recently. A variation of the Silver Age Hawkman appeared in shorts as part of the Superman-Aquaman Hour of Adventure. They both appeared during various stages of the long-running Super Friends TV series, although Hawkman's appearances far outnumber his wife's. Shiera got the better end of the deal in the Justice League Unlimited animated series that ran from 2001 to 2006. She was a founding member of the League in that universe, and with no Hawkman present, developed a romance with Green Lantern John Stewart. She ultimately is revealed as a traitor to the League, having been the plant for a Thangarian invasion. When Thanagar does invade, Shiera ultimately sides with her teammates in Earth, although her relationship with most of the team are damaged. Hawkman eventually appears, claiming to be the reincarnation of an ancient alien who became an Egyptian prince, deftly tying the Golden and Silver Age versions of the character together. He believes he and Shiera are destined to be together, as she was also his queen who ruled Egypt by his side. It is eventually revealed that Shiera loved another, who turns out to be a past life of Green Lantern, John Stewart. It is Stewart that Shiera will ultimately choose, since the series had previously introduced their son from the future, the hero known as Warhawk. Hawkman made a handful of dramatic appearances on Smallville, portrayed as a war-weary Carter Hall, tired of losing his love again and again. Hawkgirl's shattered helmet is displayed in JSA headquarters as a reminder of why he gave up the fight until Clark Kent pulls him back in again. So I know, like me, you were a big fan of the Justice League animated series.
Definitely.
And you really liked the Hawkgirl character.
I did. I mean, she was one of my favorite parts of that series. The other way, I mean, to me, how she's been portrayed in comics is not really how I view that character. I like that character as not only she's portrayed on Justice League, but also, I mean, I know she wasn't on Smallville, but how Hawkman was portrayed on there, I liked that portrayal of him. I thought the actor did a really good job with that.
Yeah, I think Michael Shanks, he was great. I would have watched a Hawkman series with him.
I think so, too. I think he could have carried it.
I love Arrow, but if they hadn't killed him, or of course he could have come back. Oh, spoiler, they killed him. But it's the nature of Hawkman. But if they had spun Hartley off as Green Arrow and done like a Justice League or a Justice Society. You can call it Justice Society so you don't tie up the Justice League movie right. And put Hawkman, Michael Shanks on there with him. Let them two anchor it. And that would have been a great show. I think that, I mean, I would have watched it. I mean, you know, I know some people don't like Smallville, and it's and I watched it. There was part of one season I didn't watch because they ticked me off so bad after the Doomsday thing.
Oh, yeah.
I missed the first few episodes that season. And actually, that might have been the season that the JSA was on, I think. But they really, toward the end there, they really started to get their act together. Yeah, the ending, I know, Welling didn't really wear the suit. It sucked. But the episodes with Hawkman, I really like those. Even the one where it was just Carter Hall.
Uh-huh.
It was in Egypt and stuff. I kept thinking they were going to do some kind of payoff with Shire.
Me
that
too.
That they were going to bring her in as a character. That, you know, she is the new reincarnation and they were going to give him more to do, but unfortunately they didn't. I'd much rather seen that been tied into the final plot and, you know, left out some of the, as much as I love the Kirby stuff, and they did okay with it considering their limitations. I was really expecting a payoff with Shire because they kind of hinted at it.
Mm-hmm.
Here and there, and
it makes you think that it was one of those storylines that they started, and they were like, "Okay, we don't have enough time to get this
right.
Wrapped up.
We can't do this and do that, and we need to end it." If it went one more season, maybe they would have done that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a shame. But the Justice League version. I mean, it's hard for me, you know, even as a comic fan that's read tons of Hawkman comics, to separate. You know, the version, the Hawk Girl on the Justice League was such a great character. It goes without saying, those guys, why they aren't running DC, Bruce Timm and
exactly. And I was getting ready to say the exact same thing. To me, and I mean, this not only applies, of course, to the different married couples, but I mean, this is across the board. To me, the Bruce Timm universe is my way, my storyline for the characters. That's the way I view the DC universe. To me, that makes sense, how that all played out and everything like that.
Yeah, I can't really argue with that.
Why would you argue with me?
Well, I if I want to sleep at night, I probably shouldn't too much. But
true.
I would, you know, as much as I love the Earth 1 continuity and the old Earth 2 continuity, and even for the most part, the post-crisis continuity, you know, I would have to agree, The DC animated universe from Batman animated on through Justice League Unlimited is pound for pound the best version of those characters. I mean, with very mm-hmm. few missteps, that is the most. We're not saying anything anybody has said before, but they distilled the characters down to the essence. They took characters that were a little jumbled and like Hawk Girl and defined, say, okay, Hawk Girl, she's got a mace, she's tough. But, you know, she's got this softer side. You know, the things they did with her and Grundy, that was great. You know, the romance with her and Green Lantern was great. And, you know, kind of ahead of its time. I mean, even in the years since that come on, it's, you know, interracial relationship on TV wasn't that common, especially on a kid's cartoon. How, you know, of course you could say it's interspecies because she's from Thanagar, but
true.
She looked, you know, Caucasian or whatever. So, I mean, that was cool. I mean, that they did that and they put that out there and, you know, as much as a purist I am, it was done so well. I didn't mind that Hawkman wasn't around and her and John were becoming an item. It didn't bother me, you know, so those guys can do that, you know. So, you know, why Bruce Timm isn't running DC, I have no idea. Well, that'll about do it for this week's episode. Come back in 2 weeks, and we will continue our married couple theme with the two big ones, the wall crawler known as Spider-Man and Mary Jane, and the Man of Steel, Superman, and his significant other, Lois Lane.
Also known as Miss Clueless.
We'd love to hear your comments. You can drop us a line on our blog or email us at supermatespodcast@gmail.com. Before we go, I'd like to thank Rob Kelly and Andrew Leyland, who I mentioned before, and also Brian Heiler of Pod Stallions, who gave me a lot of great podcast advice, and I really appreciate their help. So thanks, guys, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye. Supermates is a Franklin & Franklin production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises worldwide. The fictional characters and events mentioned in this show are trademark and copyright their respective owners. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their owners, and we mean no infringement by either. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geek Cast.